And as Kirk alluded to earlier in the service, usually we would, in the church's calendar, get to this a little later. We're mainly getting to it because we're just working through the Gospel of Mark. And so even though it's not quite Lent yet, Lent does start soon. We'll talk about that in the weeks to come. One of the things that the Lent is there to do in the church calendar is to prepare us for Good Friday and Easter in the final week of Jesus's life. As we go into Mark 11 this morning, we get to spend from now until Easter in Mark 11 through 16. And just in case this is not clear, or just as a reminder, starting in Mark 11, even though it's six chapters, there's only 16 chapters in Mark, we still have six chapters to go. This is not quite half the story, but it's well more than a third of the story. Everything from Mark 11 to the end of the story takes place in the final week of Jesus's life. And so this entire end of the gospel is focused on the days leading up to the crucifixion, the resurrection. This is one of the reasons that a famous 20th century German New Testament scholar named Martin Kahler very famously said that the gospels, and he was particularly talking about Mark, but said ultimately it's true of all four gospels, that what they really are is passion narratives with extended introductions. That what they're really focused on is the final week of Jesus's life. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but even going back for a moment to the Apostles' Creed basically skips from Jesus's birth to his death. Like, there's almost nothing in between. And even in that, there's, I think, a reflection and a recognition that whatever else the rest of Jesus's story is about, it cannot be understood. And it finally doesn't have any true significance to it, at least not the significance that it actually has, unless it's seen in light of the cross and leading up to it. And so over these next months, leading all the way up to Easter Sunday, we get to spend an extended amount of time in the final week of Jesus's life. And in all the Gospels, the triumphal entry is the introduction, the beginning, the inauguration of his final week. So let's look at it, and let me begin here. Some of you have heard me say this before. I am sure, Lord willing, that you will get to hear me say it at times in the future. When I went to college, I was hoping to be a writer. Not exactly sure what that would look like, but I majored in something called English writing at my college, which was kind of a combination of journalism and literature. And I learned very early on that every literature professor in the history of the world, or at least in recent history in America, often is frustrated at the inability of people to use the category of irony the right way. That irony, or something being ironic, is often used in a way that it has nothing to do with irony. And I'm going to make a claim, both in the triumphal procession today, but in the weeks to come, that you cannot understand the story of Jesus unless you know how irony works. That you cannot understand what the gospel writers are doing overall, even what the rest of the New Testament writers are often doing. For instance, those two passages, 2 Corinthians 2, in Colossians, we read, cannot be understood if we don't know how irony works. And irony is often itself deeply misunderstood. I'll just use a famous and kind of dated example, but nonetheless still a good one. When I was in high school in 1996, Alanis Morissette released her song, Ironic. And it's often been pointed out, even though it's a great tune and she's a great musician, it's often pointed out that every single example she uses in the song, that not a single one of them is actually irony. I'll just give you a couple of examples. It rains on your wedding day. The first flight you ever get on crashes and you die. The man of your dreams that you meet is already married. There's 10,000 spoons lying around that all you need is a knife. You win the lottery and you die the next day. A death row pardon comes, but 2 minutes too late. The good advice you just didn't take. The free ride offered to you after you've already paid. A traffic jam when you're already late, and so on and so on. Not a single example in that song called Ironic is ironic. They're absurd. Some of them are tragic. Some of them are deeply frustrating, but that has nothing to do with irony. And so here's two very brief definitions of irony that will help, I think, clarify what exactly Jesus is doing in the triumphal entry. And Jesus has consistently been ironic throughout this gospel, and much of what will happen in the final week of his life will be misunderstood, as characters in Mark have consistently misunderstood Jesus, unless we kind of know how this works. So here's one definition of irony. It is the expression of one's meaning by using language that normally signifies the opposite. It's saying one thing that seems to lean in this direction, but your meaning actually goes in the opposite direction. And then this definition of myth, especially in modern culture, irony tends to be used for humorous effect, but it can also be used for emphatic effect. And I'm going to argue that while irony in the scriptures and in the gospels, it can be funny, it can be humorous, that it's almost never the reason it's being used. Even that when someone says something ironic, they're trying to make a joke, trying to be funny, that itself is a bit misleading, that in scripture, sure, irony is there not to be funny, but to be revelatory, to get us to see something that we would otherwise miss, or to get us to see something we've always been looking at, but we don't really see what it is. Irony says on the surface the opposite of what's intended. Here's the second definition: a state of affairs or an event that seems deliberately contrary to what one expects. I think both of those definitions are really good kind of paradigms to bring the triumphal entry, that the language of the triumphal entry is going in the exact opposite direction of its meaning, that what Jesus is doing, and Jesus is setting this up, you hopefully get that sense in Mark 11, that they're sending them for the donkey, having the cloaks thrown over it, everything else, Jesus is setting it up to be experienced by people in a certain way. But he wants them to experience it in a way that will subvert their expectations, that will cause them to take a double glance at it, that does not fulfill what they think this kind of imagery points to. And so let me give a couple of examples, and then we'll move into Mark 11, of just how irony, once you see this dynamic, is everywhere in the story of Jesus. Again, just want to reiterate, I don't think that we can really understand Jesus all that well if we're always just taking the surface view, the surface meaning of what's being said, without also understanding how profoundly subversive, how profoundly ironic the language, the imagery, the events of Jesus' life are. Do you remember, just last week, James and John came up to Jesus and said, Jesus, when you become king, when you finally enter into your glory and you make it big, we want to sit at your right hand and your left hand. And we saw that Jesus' response was not to say, oh, you arrogant men, but to say, I don't think you know what you're asking for. That what this language means on the surface will be revealed when Jesus is enthroned as king on the cross and two men are sitting at his right hand and his left hand, crucified with him. This is what it actually means to reign with Christ in the kingdom of God. That's irony. Another example, I mentioned this one last week, so I'll be brief, is when the soldiers, the Roman soldiers, are putting the crown of thorns on his head and beating him with the reed and then putting in his hand as a scepter, putting a purple robe on him, bowing down to him, they actually think they're being ironic. And you could almost say that the gospel writers have a double irony there, that they're actually exactly telling the truth. That they think they're doing something on the surface which contradicts what's happening, but they are actually acknowledging what is happening at that moment. There's a double level of irony there. When the disciples ask, who's the greatest? And Jesus brings forth a child. When they say, what do we need to do to be first? And Jesus says, be like a waiter at a restaurant. Be like a slave who has a master. That's irony. That's subverting expectations. When the disciples ask, Jesus, we've left everything to follow you. What reward will we have? And I didn't get a chance to flesh this out last week, but the final thing Jesus says in what you get right now that's 100-fold better than what you're giving up is persecutions. That's irony. It's subverting our expectations of what the good life looks like. The transfiguration we kicked off with over a month ago now, and the fact that the transfiguration, this moment of glory, this moment of greatness, this moment of majesty, is framed on both sides by Jesus saying, I'm going to die, I'm going to be rejected, I'm going to be humiliated, I'm going to lose. That the transfiguration is bounded by two passion predictions of humiliation, rejection, loneliness, torture. That's irony. That's messing with, subverting our sense of what glory actually means. In the Gospel of John, I'll just give a couple of more and we'll move on. I really want us to have this as our framework. In the Gospel of John, the high priest is Caiaphas, and there is a story recounted where in kind of a back room, smoke-filled room, he with some of the other religious leaders basically conspire and decide Jesus needs to die. And in Caiaphas's mouth, these words come out, because it is better for one man to perish than for the entire nation to be destroyed. And John makes a big deal out of that, that in Caiaphas' own meaning, he's just one more Machiavellian politician in history who knows you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, and it's going to be somebody else's eggs so that me and mine can eat the omelet. That's all Caiaphas means. He's just corrupt. But on another level, that is exactly what is going to happen through their sinful acts, that it is better for one man to die than for the rest of the people of God to perish. There is irony in that moment, and the triumphal entry is filled with irony. In 2 Corinthians, just to use one from Paul, and then we'll come back to Mark, Paul, in that passage in 2 Corinthians 4 that we read, where he says, we're persecuted, we're struck down, we're forsaken, we're weak, we're this, we have this treasure, but it's in jars of clay. In the context of 2 Corinthians, and by the way, if you want to pursue this more, 2 Corinthians is certainly the most ironic document in the New Testament. One of the reasons it is often, I think, difficult for Christians today to get their minds around it is that it is thoroughly dominated by irony. And I'll just give you one example. A group of outsiders have snuck in or come in since Paul left to the church in Corinth, and they've got resumes. They've got their CVs, and they're handing them out to the Corinthians, and it lets the Corinthians know, went to Harvard for undergrad, did my internship at this great law firm in Manhattan, and here's three professors that think I'm the greatest thing ever. Here's my current kind of bottom line. Here's how much I'm worth, that they're handing out their resumes to the Corinthians of what they've accomplished in trying to impress the Corinthians that this is what it looks like to belong to Jesus. It's to be really impressive. And throughout the letter, Paul several times says, I don't want to do this, but you're forcing me to do this, is Paul gives his counter resume to the Corinthians. And he says, here's how many times I've been beaten. Here's how many times I've been rejected. Here's how many scars I have on my back from all the times I've been whipped. And there was this one time where I was in a city and I was so thoroughly rejected by the people and the message that I preached, and I was so thoroughly not accepted and not successful in the mission that I had to sneak down in a basket from the wall to escape the next day. And in all these things Paul says, he's listing his weaknesses, his failures, what humanly speaking, the entire history of the world would say this is somebody who didn't accomplish what they set out to do. And Paul is giving them his resume saying, here's how you know I'm an apostle. And he's not saying, in spite of these things, you can know I'm an apostle. He is saying, precisely through these things, you should be able to recognize that I'm the kind of guy who belongs to Jesus and represents him in the world. This is irony. And if we don't see this, so much of the New Testament will fall on deaf ears. And so coming back to Mark 11, where is the irony here? Might be later today, might be in the days to come. Encourage you to read and reflect on those two great quotes at the beginning of our bulletin by Martin Luther and John Calvin. They both perceived very clearly the irony of this moment. One thing that's helpful to see it, and then we're going to break down how the triumphal procession does this, is here's three things I want you to see in the triumphal procession. They're all pretty clear on the surface, but then we'll see how they subvert expectations. The first is the triumphal procession, both in Mark and in all the other Gospels, is clearly presented as Jesus' coming out party as the Messiah. This is the first moment where Jesus, not just to his disciples, which has happened in chapter 8 through 10, and only the Father, only Jesus and demons know in the first 8 chapters, even the disciples don't know he's the Messiah then, or at least not for sure. Then he reveals it to the disciples in these last chapters we've been in. This is the moment when Jesus goes public with the fact that he's the Messiah. All of the imagery here very clearly conveys that. And the fact that in the chapters to come, there will be people, especially religious leaders, who come up and say, where does your authority come from? And question him. It's not that they're unsure of whether Jesus is claiming to be the Messiah. From here on out, Jesus is claimed to be the Messiah publicly. It is that, wait, you wrote into Jerusalem, but everything you have done since then has not lined up at all with what we thought that moment was about. In some ways, it's kind of like John the Baptist earlier on in jail saying, are you the one who is to come, or should I keep looking for somebody else? Because I thought you were, but everything you've done since then, this is not what I thought the Messiah was like. The triumphal procession is Jesus' coming out party as the Messiah. It's also, to be more specific, both, and this is where the Old Testament background is so important, it is the return of a king from David's line to sit on Jerusalem's throne, which has been empty and has not had a Davidic king for centuries. It is that moment. Notice that when Jesus rides into the city, blessed be the God of our father David and his coming kingdom. Finally, the return of the king. Finally, a son of David is coming to rule over Jerusalem as God had always intended, as he's always promised. But that throne has been empty for centuries by this point in time. And specifically, you could think of Ezekiel, you think of Isaiah, that one of the great ambiguities of the Old Testament is that when the first temple is destroyed in around 587 BC by the Babylonians, that's the end of the Davidic line. The Davidic kings are carried off into exile and they never reign over an independent Israel again. And when God's presence leaves the people of God and the people of God themselves go into exile, eventually the people slowly come back to the land. Eventually they begin rebuilding some of the ruins, but there is never a moment in the Old Testament story where the glory and the presence of God go into the second temple the way that at the end of Exodus, God's presence went into the tabernacle, in the way that in Solomon's reign, that the presence of God went into the first temple. It's at least open to interpretation, and I think maybe even suggested that this second temple has never been re-inhabited by God, that God has not returned to Jerusalem fully. And I think one thing that this moment, and starting next week, you can see it in verse 11 in the anticlimactic end, that the first thing Jesus does after he arrives in the city is he goes into the temple. The temple is going to be very central for the rest of the Gospel of Mark, that God is returning to his temple, that God's presence is returning to his people. And even there, we should be able to begin to sense irony that this is a story that is going to end with a human being who claims to be the returning king of David, who claims to be the embodiment of the God of Israel, who's bringing God's presence back to Jerusalem, hanging on a cross, saying, my God, why have you abandoned me? Why have you forsaken me? And yet this is the event when God is returning to his people. But that's what the triumphal entry begins to indicate. And then finally, we're going to see, and we'll spend most of the rest of the time we have on this one, that it is, and this is where the irony is most thick and most rich, that it is not just a triumphal procession, but it's a triumphal procession of the warrior, of the divine warrior who comes to lead God's people to defeat their enemies, to overthrow their oppressors. That this is a military moment. This is a military image, that Jesus is a warrior in this moment. That is very central to the irony. So let's look at these in order real quick. That is, his coming out party as the Messiah. In the Gospel of Matthew, we're told the whole city quaked. It was literally seismic. In Luke, we're told the crowds were electrified. That this is Jesus, the red carpet being rolled out for Jesus. This is his ticker tape parade at the end of World War II. This is, not to be too corny, but this is his Super Bowl Sunday. This is the big moment that everything has led up to. And the strangest thing is that Jesus shows up wearing the wrong outfit. Jesus shows up wearing a janitor's outfit ready to clean a toilet, rather that he's not dressed for the moment. But it's not that he doesn't recognize it, but he deliberately provokes what happens here. Anne Lamott is a great writer that many of you will have heard of or know. And at one place in her, in one place in her writing, she says this: often, not always, but often, expectations are resentments under construction. That is, what we expect from life, from one another, from God, are often the beginning of what will turn out to be resentments later on, because our expectations were not fulfilled, because we didn't get what we wanted, because God didn't give what we hoped to, what that other people didn't live up to what we desired from them. And it's always been pointed out in Christian history, and I think rightly so, that these are the same people in the crowd who days later, having now said, this is amazing, Jesus, they're cheering, they're saying, blessed is the God who has done this, Hosanna, and days later they will be crying out, crucify him, crucify him. These expectations are going to turn into resentment very quickly. But nonetheless, the reasons they turn into resentment is that Jesus is done with secrecy. He is done with ambiguity. He is openly announcing that he is the Messiah. I'm going to send this out later on. We'll talk about it just briefly this morning. But even though Mark doesn't say it explicitly, Matthew and Luke both do. I think maybe John does as well. I forget that when Jesus chooses a donkey or a colt to ride into, this is clearly evoking Zechariah 9, where the returning king will ride, will come to you on a donkey, on a colt. Not only Zechariah 9 was probably already itself evoking Genesis 49, one of the earliest messianic passages in scripture. For those of you who've been joining us on Wednesday nights for our first Samuel Bible study, we've talked about this passage a few times, that the scepter will not depart from Judah, that there will be a coming king. That's Genesis 49:10. What's often missed is that the next verse, verse 11, is that he will come seated on a colt, on a donkey. And so Genesis 49, Zechariah 9, this is the language, this is the imagery of the Messiah from Judah, the returning king of David. This is what Jesus is evoking. One thing you might do, especially because we have from now all the way until Easter in these chapters in Mark, this is both because this is such an obscure place in the Old Testament, and to be honest, a very difficult place in the Old Testament. One thing you might do, and at the very least want to help us recognize this, is starting now until the end of the story, and this is not just true of Mark, it's true of Matthew, it's true of Luke, it's true of John, is the Old Testament will dominate these final days of Jesus' life. Jesus will do this to fulfill that from the Old Testament. He'll do this, which reminds them of something that happened in Israel's scriptures. It's not just that the Old Testament thoroughly shapes and colors and shadows what Jesus is doing and saying in these final days, but there's one specific place in the Old Testament where the vast majority of the imagery comes from. But as I said, it's a very obscure place. It's Zechariah in the second half of Zechariah, chapters 9 through 14. I would encourage you to consider, between now and Easter, maybe trying to read Zechariah 9 through 14 a couple of times. It is, in a very real sense, the script that Jesus is using for what he does in the coming last week of his life. Let me give you a couple of examples real quick. Zechariah 9:9, your humble king is coming to you riding upon a donkey. There's the triumphal entry. Zechariah 10, verse 2, the people of God are like sheep without a shepherd, quoted in the Gospels. Zechariah 11, 12 and 13, some mysterious figure, there's a big debate about who this is, although I think the Gospel writers clearly had a view on who this was. A mysterious figure is sold out by a trader for 30 pieces of silver, the money of which is then thrown to the potter in the house of the Lord. Clearly evoked by the Gospel writers for Judas conspiring with the high priest, with the religious leaders in the temple, and the money for which would later be used for a potter's field. Zechariah 12, verse 10, talks about the house of David returning, and then us, whoever we are, looking upon one whom we have pierced, and then after committing that terrible act, mourning as if for an only child. Absolutely. In this final week, Zechariah 13, verse 7 will say, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered, which is quoted at Gethsemane a couple of days later. Zechariah 14, verse 4 identifies the Mount of Olives as the location where the Lord will return in to get ready for the final battle. And then this interesting imagery, which should sound halfway familiar, and then the mountain will be torn in two and thrown into the sea, which is the very thing Jesus says will happen if you have faith. That's often taken in a very health and wealth prosperity gospel way, but there's actually a much bigger context to that. And anyway, Zechariah 14, verse 21, that on this day when the Lord returns to fight the last battle, to defeat his people's enemies and to save them and redeem them, on that day there will be no traitors, not traitors, but with a D, traitors, selling things in the house of the Lord, which is clearly in the background to Jesus cleansing the temple, which will be next week. And so anyway, consider reading Zechariah 9 through 14. It is in many ways the script that Jesus is using, that the gospel writers are filling out with what happens. And so much of what Jesus says and does in these final days makes much more sense in light of that. And then final thing before I move on is often been pointed out, especially by Christian interpreters, and I think rightly so, that the mysterious figure, the shepherd, who seems to be pierced, but who, having been rejected by his people, then brings salvation to them mysteriously in Zechariah 9 through 14, sounds, if you pay attention, eerily similar to the servant of the Lord in the second half of Isaiah. I think Zechariah 9 through 14 is just a slightly different angle on the servant of the Lord in Isaiah. And so Jesus is evoking this imagery, but also being deeply subversive in the way he uses it All right, the second point that I mentioned is that this is the return of the Davidic king, the return of the God of Israel. In the background, almost certainly, to the expectations of the crowd, are at least two events. One, 300 years before Jesus, 300 years before Jesus rides this donkey into Jerusalem, Alexander the Great rode through these same gates into Jerusalem, having conquered them, among many others, on a war horse. And Alexander the Great, entering Jerusalem as a conquering king on a war horse, is almost certainly being parodied by Jesus in the riding the opposite of a war horse, a donkey, a colt. Even more significantly, this story is sometimes not as well known to us as Christians today. It, among Catholics, it's in the Apocrypha. For many Protestants, we never really read it. But, for instance, if you have any Jewish friends who take very seriously and celebrate Hanukkah, Hanukkah is the celebration of and the memory of a story that takes place in 1 Maccabees. And 1 Maccabees takes place about 167 to 142 BC, which is a little over a century before Jesus. This is very recent. And in 1 Maccabees, there is a man named Judas Maccabeus, and Maccabeus is itself just a Jewish phrase for the hammer. This is a guy who's strong. This is a guy who pulverizes his enemies. And 1 Maccabees is a very bloody and a very violent book. The Maccabeans rise up and they both commit a lot of violence against their fellow Jews who are too lax in observing the law, who are not circumcised or keeping kosher, or who are conspiring with the enemy. And then they engage for almost 25 years in a guerrilla warfare campaign against King Antiochus, and against the Seleucids, and against those who are just the latest oppressors who have taken over Israel, not allowing them to have their own king, not allowing them to worship rightly in the temple. They desecrate the temple. And the Maccabees, for a very short amount of time, through violence, through war, are actually able to overthrow their oppressors and to reestablish for a short time their independence. They kind of have their own king. He's not a Davidic descendant, but they do have their own leader. And this group is celebrated. And during the Maccabean revolt, Simon, who is Judas's brother, actually rides into the city of Jerusalem. And let me read this to you. These are two verses from 1 Maccabees chapter 13. On the 23rd day of the second month, in the 171st year, the Jews entered the temple in Jerusalem, having ridden through the gates of Jerusalem, with praise and palm branches, and with harps and cymbals and stringed instruments, and with hymns and songs, because a great army had been crushed through violence, through war, and removed from Israel. And Simon decreed that every year they should celebrate this day with rejoicing, and we still do. In any Jewish community, even here in New York City, Hanukkah is a day off every year for school, and this is what it's about. It's remembering a violent leader who, through coercion and through warfare, was able for a time to defeat the enemies of Israel and to restore Jerusalem to what they thought it should be, and Jesus is evoking that in this moment. Palm branches, the riding in, even the hymns and the songs, Psalm 118 in the background. And in, again, the chapters to come, Jesus' kingship and his authority in the temple, the return of God's presence temple, these two themes will dominate the final week of Jesus' life. So final thing, and here's where the irony especially comes to the surface, that Jesus comes in like Alexander, like Simon, like Judas Maccabeus, like a conqueror, like a warrior who knows that the people in charge shouldn't be in charge, that we're oppressed by our enemies, and that a battle needs to take place to set things right. And he comes in for this battle, and he comes in on a donkey, on a foal. He refuses to use violence. He refuses to engage in that. And he ends up days later hanging on a cross, and somehow this is meant to be the fulfillment of it. And so here's a couple of things that the triumphal entry is getting us ready for in the coming weeks. That Jesus is going to identify the enemy differently than anybody else had before. Jesus is going to identify the mode of warfare that is required to defeat this enemy. It's very differently than was currently understood. And Jesus is going to pursue a goal and an outcome in this battle that is very, very, very different than what other conquering kings and heroes, or would be conquering kings and heroes who had entered the city, were going to do. There is an ancient Greek philosopher that the Eugene Peterson often quotes that I find helpful, named Mencius, and Eugene Peterson always quotes this, and he says, before a human being can decide what they're going to do in the world, how they're going to try to achieve their aims, they need to first decide what they are not willing to do, no matter what. And the triumphal entry and what comes after it is Jesus' statement of what he is not willing to do. He has not come to raise an army. When Peter pulls out a sword a couple of days later and cuts off the ear of one of those who's coming to arrest Jesus, Jesus is going to tell him to put away his sword and heal the man's ear. Jesus is going to repeatedly have opportunities to use violence and to incite other people to violence. If Jesus has his January 6th Capitol Hill insurrection moment, it's right now, Jesus could very easily stir this crowd up to violence. And he chooses not to. He refuses to, because that's not the kind of king, that's not the kind of warrior he is. One of my favorite movies of all time is from the early 80s. It's called The Mission. It's with Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro. You might watch it in the months to come before Easter. It's got one of the great musical soundtracks, I think, in films of all time. And it's a story of Jesuit priests in South America in the 1750s, and the Robert De Niro and the Jeremy Irons character are both good characters, are both priests. The Robert De Niro character especially is this former slave trader who has a pretty moving and incredible conversion experience in the story. And he's mentored by and becomes a Jesuit priest under Jeremy Irons. But then when the various European imperialistic nations, and I think in this movie it's specifically Portugal and maybe France, are warring with each other over the territory that this mission, that this kind of Christian outpost is, where they have been preaching the gospel to the natives. Many of the natives have become Christians. And there's these images in the first half of the movie of incredible transformation, peace. Tribes that were formerly warring against each other have now learned to live in harmony. They're all living in peace. One of the things I love about the movie is that it is incredibly uncynical about the church. It very clearly distinguishes between the European monarchs and their aims economically and colonially and the church, or at least some in the church who are doing something different. But the heart of the story is the dilemma at the end, which is the mission is shut down. The Jesuit priests are told they need to go home, that the Pope is calling them home, and that the mission is going to be destroyed, that the natives are going to be enslaved, and that this is now, you know, Portugal's land, this is now Spain's land, whatever it is. And both Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro agree, we're not going to do that. We're not going to just bow down to this moment of evil. But the way they choose to respond to this oppression, to this evil, is diametrically different. Robert De Niro goes back to his old slave trading ways, and he finds all his old guns and weapons, and he begins teaching the natives how to fight and how to be soldiers. And Jeremy Irons gets into conflict with Robert De Niro and says, we cannot do this. If we do this, we have lost everything we work for. And so instead, as the invading army gets closer, they pray and they love and they plant gardens and they play music and they just continue to be the people of God they're supposed to be. And this movie came out almost 40 years ago, so I feel like I'm allowed to ruin the ending. I'm not spoiling anything. Everybody ends up dead at the end of this movie. Robert De Niro and his group ends up dead. Jeremy Irons and his group ends up dead. In some ways, this movie always reminds me of something that Stanley Hauerwas often quips, which is that maybe the central myth of American culture, that if you just keep running the race long enough, if you just keep pursuing what you want doggedly enough, if you're just willing to just mow down anybody in your path, cause suffering to come upon them so that you get what you want or avoid suffering, that if you just do that enough, that you could get out of life alive. In the story of the cross, in the mission, it reminds us that death and loss and suffering are unavoidable in this life. The question is, what are we going to do in response to it? And Jesus identifies that loving his enemies and laying down his life for them is the way to fight this battle, not by getting a bigger army and causing my enemies to suffer so that we get what we want or avoid what we had hoped not to suffer. That's not what happens. And there is this wonderful final image. It's actually hopeful, in case you think the story is just tragic in the mission, where after all this tragedy has happened and the Jesuit mission is wiped out is some of the native children have escaped by the side. And the final scene of the movie is some of the native children getting into the canoe and rowing down the river back into the jungle. And the child who's kind of leading it, doesn't look like he's any more than 12 years old, is confronted implicitly with a choice that he sees a violin laying on the ground, the Jeremy Irons character, and he sees a gun lying on the ground, and he walks over the gun and he picks up the violin. And he rows into the jungle. And it's just a reminder of the kind of reality that Jesus has brought, that we do not fight our battles through violence. We do not kill our enemies. We do not seek to destroy our enemies. We seek to love our enemies and to lay our life down for them. And so as we end, I just want to give us two thoughts to reflect on with this. And again, in many ways, this just gets us ready for everything that will happen in the Passion Week. The first is this. That enthusiasm, passion, and zeal do not necessarily equal faith, discipleship, or spiritual maturity. There are often Christians, individually or in groups, who think that if we just rile people up like this, we just have people being really loud, being really passionate, being very zealous, being very confrontational towards all we think is wrong, that somehow that's Christian maturity. And the zeal of the crowds and the violent aspirations and the selfish aspirations, what people were projecting idolatrously upon Jesus, reminds us that simply getting people riled up, simply being really passionate for what you think is good and being very zealous against what you think is evil, is not necessarily a marker of discipleship, of faith, of spiritual maturity. We need to be discerning. That's one of the things this irony is doing. It's forcing us to think through what exactly does Jesus want from us. But then second, this is always a good call for every church, is that popularity, success, bringing in a great crowd, effectiveness in getting things done is not at all the same thing as being part of the coming kingdom of God. By the end, Jesus will be surrounded by very few, a couple of women, even his closest followers will have departed him, and these crowds will have turned on him, and yet this was what it looked like to be part of the coming of the kingdom of God. And those who can draw bigger crowds and rile people up, that's not necessarily an indication that we're part of what God is doing in the world. We relentlessly, I find, I do too, tend to evaluate whether God is in something or whether God has abandoned something the same way the world evaluates it. And the triumphal entry and what follows us reminds us that that's not true. Second and last thing, and ultimately, the one thing I hope that we take away from this above all else is we have seen over and over in the Gospel of Mark, and it is still true here, that this is not just the story of Jesus, it's our story. It's not just Christology, who Jesus is, it's discipleship, who we're supposed to be. That what Jesus does, he did for us, but it's also a pattern for us to adopt. It's also a template for us to pursue together and individually as we do it. And here's the way I put it very simply, that the church, when it understands its task, Christians, when they understand their own identity, seek to fight and conquer and triumph just as Jesus did. That Jesus' way of conquering is our way of conquering. Sin and evil and death and everything else. That we don't fight the way the world does, as the Apostle Paul says. We don't adopt the same weapons of warfare of the flesh, but we have weapons that Paul will later talk about, the gospel and peace and truth and love, that these are the weapons with which we fight with. And so I want to end with, and I'll send this around later, I know it's a bit of a lengthier quote, it'll be about three paragraphs long than I would usually read, but instead of putting it on the screen, I just want you to hear this. It is very easy to follow, and then I'll send it around later. This is from Jonathan Edwards, the 18th century Puritan in America, and in his discussion in Religious Affections, in which he says one of the central characteristics of every true Christian is meekness, humility, gentleness, and he points to the triumphal entry as one of the proofs for that, is then he raises an objection that he thinks many zealous Christians will bring up, which is, okay, like meekness, yeah, quietness and gentleness, yeah, you know, humility, yeah, what about boldness? What about courage? What about confronting evil? What about telling people who are wrong and awful the truth of God and getting in their face and not caring when people hate you in response? What about all that stuff? And Edwards gives the best response I've ever heard, which isn't, well, sometimes we're meek and sometimes we're gentle, but then sometimes we give it to people the way they give it to us. Sometimes we get really nasty. Sometimes we get really cruel. Sometimes we get really violent and dark. No. It's this. The warfare imagery is ironically redefined by the gentleness and the meekness and the humility image. That is the way we fight. That is the way we engage evil. So let me end with this excerpt from Jonathan Edwards. But here, some may be ready to say, yeah, but is there no such thing as Christian fortitude and boldness for Christ, being good soldiers in the Christian warfare, coming out boldly against all the enemies of Christ and his people in the world? To which I answer, there doubtless is such a thing, yes. The whole Christian life is compared to a warfare, a battle, and rightly so. And the most eminent Christians are the best soldiers in Jesus' army, endued with the greatest degrees of Christian fortitude and courage. Then he says this, the directest and surest way in the world to make a right judgment about what holy passion and courage for God is and fighting with God's enemies in the world is to look to the captain of all of God's hosts and our great leader and example, and to see wherein his fortitude and valor and bravery appeared in his chief conflict in life and in the time of the greatest battle that ever was in the history of the world or ever will be fought with these enemies, when he fought with them alone, and of all the people there was no one left with him, and he exercised his fortitude in the highest degree that he ever did in that moment and got that glorious victory, which will be celebrated in the praises and the triumphs of all the hosts of heaven for all of eternity. Even to Jesus Christ, in the time of his last sufferings, when his enemies in earth and in hell made their most violent attack upon him, compassing him round about on every side like renting and roaring lions. Doubtless it is here in this moment that we shall see the true fortitude of a holy warrior and a champion in the cause of God in the world, in its highest perfection, in its greatest luster and beauty, and an example for all who desire to be soldiers of Jesus to fight under their captain. And then he ends with this. But how did Jesus show his holy boldness? How did he fight his enemies? How did he demonstrate his valor at that time? Not in the exercise of any fiery passions, not in fierce and violent speeches condemning his enemies, vehemently declaiming against and crying out of the intolerable wickedness of all those who oppressed him, giving them their own in plain terms, but rather in not even opening his mouth when he was afflicted and oppressed, in going as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is dumb, not opening his mouth, praying that the Father would forgive his cruel enemies because they knew not what they did, not shedding others' blood, but with all conquering patience and love, shedding his own for them. Indeed, one of his disciples, Peter, then made a forward pretense to being very bold for Christ throughout his ministry and confidently declared that he would sooner die with Christ than deny him, began to lay about him with a sword, but Christ meekly rebukes Peter and heals the wound that he gave. And never was the patience, meekness, love, and forgiveness of Christ in so glorious a manifestation as at this time, in the final week of his life. Never did he appear so much a lamb, and never did he show so much of the dove-like spirit as at that time when he was actually being a lion. He's actually being a warrior. If, therefore, we see any of the followers of Jesus in the world in the midst of the most violent, unreasonable, and wicked opposition of God's and his own enemies, maintaining under all this temptation the same humility, quietness, gentleness of a lamb, harmlessness, love for enemies, and sweetness of a dove, we may well judge that here is a good soldier of Christ Jesus. We fight as Jesus fought. And so as we end, let me just say this. Imagine if this is what the church was known for. Imagine if this is how the church responded to evil in our own lives and in the world. Imagine if this was the template. Imagine if the church had the same kind of ironic existence in its warfare in the world that Jesus had in his. If we miss the irony, we miss the point of the fight. We miss how to fight, what to fight about, and how to engage in it. The triumphal entry gets us on track to hear in a new way that we would otherwise miss what is about to happen in the days to come. And we get to spend all of our time up until Easter in that, which I'm looking forward to. Let me pray.